very few people have done any moon bounce on the 10-meter band. A couple of guys, one of them is a friend of mine in Texas, has done moon bounce on the 50-megacycle band, but they're rare. The majority of guys on moon bounce are using 144 megacycles and higher. The main reason for that is that you go higher in frequency, the wavelength is smaller. A smaller wavelength means that the amount of area you can dedicate to an antenna in either a phased array or a parabolic dish or a collinear array, the amount of area in square feet or square meters that you and I can dedicate to an antenna represents some number of wavelengths of width and height. As the number of wavelengths increases, the beam width gets smaller, the directivity gets up, the gain goes higher, so more of the signal is hitting the moon. So it is considerably easier to make moon bounce at 432 than it is at 50 megacycles if you're area limited and horsepower limited, power output limited.
Okay, let me ask you a question. You have a moon bouncing and you have an ionosphere bouncing. What frequencies, the lowest one, would you apply for the ionospheric bouncing?
Depending on the state of the sunspot cycles and the part of the time of the year and the time of the day, ionosphere will give you a reflection down to the lowest frequency you can imagine.
So that would be?
The highest usable frequency is what you most usually care about. I think the ionosphere, when it's there, goes down to DC.
Oh, I like it. I have a beautiful article that I'm going to send you the copy of it from 1954. And it was a real experiment done in Mojave Desert at a frequency from 100 kilohertz, sending about both a government building at that time and 1 megawatt transmitter operating in the frequency of from 14.5 to 35 kilohertz per second, edge Arlington, Washington area as well, and Turkey.
So the bottom line of all this is that there's a certain amount of dBs of path loss you've got to overcome. How big is your antenna? How high is your transmitter power? How sensitive is your receiver? What's the bandwidth of the receiver? And many of these measurements realize that in order for you to confirm the antenna performance, under normal circumstances, you would put the antenna in an anechoic chamber, and hopefully you've got a friend somewhere that gives you access to that anechoic chamber. Well, you take, for instance, that 12-foot dish that I use to do listening of the Apollo astronauts. In order to confirm the performance of that antenna, I would have needed an anechoic chamber 700 feet long. That doesn't exist. Therefore, I aimed the antenna at the sun, and I made a radio astronomy measurement. Many of these moon-bound systems confirm the performance, the gain-to-temperature ratio of the antenna-receiving system by either making radio astronomy measurements by looking at Cassiopeia A or Cygnus X star or looking at the sun. So you'll see that some of these calculations are what's the ratio of sun noise to cold sky noise you'll measure when the antenna is working correctly and you first aim it at the sun, then you aim it at cold sky. That ratio between the two, measured in the radiometry manner, which is not just looking at your S meter on your receiver, something very specific about a radiometer. But when you use a radiometer correctly, you can confirm the performance of your antenna. You'll know that it is or it is not working correctly, and you know to either improve it or to work on the rest of the system. There's a whole lot of components that have to work just right, and you're using the state-of-the-art of transmitters, receivers, and antennas, and low-noise amplifiers in order to really do moon bounce. It definitely separates the men from the boys. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
No, he was turning it back to you, Wes.
I may have used the wrong call letters. I'm sorry about that. Wes and 2XJN. So, some of the calculations are really to confirm by radio astronomy measurements whether or not the antenna and the electronics connected to the antenna is doing the job. The feed horn, you have to put an amazing amount of science into the feed horn. The horn that's at the focal point of the parabolic dish, if it's a prime-fed dish as opposed to a cassegrain dish, that horn, you want it to smear the energy evenly across the whole surface. You'll get the highest efficiency out of the parabolic dish if every square meter of the dish has the same number of watts on it when you're transmitting, and every bit of it is in phase. Well, no feed horn can do that.
It is a perfect idea for rover station, because it offers moderate gain at small package.
I don't agree with that. In order to get enough primary pattern control of the feed horn, so that when you're in my, let me pick a number, I decide to build a 24-foot diameter parabolic dish antenna for, let's say, 1296 band. I'd like to design a feed horn that evenly transmits the power from the feed horn across the surface of the parabolic dish, where every square meter of the dish gets the same number of watts.
And what was the impedance?
And all of the watts fall to zero at the edge of the dish. In order to make a feed horn do that, I would have to have a phased array cluster feed horn of about 32 individual elements to get that degree of control. That 32 element phased array cluster feed horn assembly that I just described would be bigger than the dish. Therefore, the shadow it creates would negate the dish. I'd be better off aiming the feed horn at the target, and the hell with the parabolic dish. For that reason, because of the wavelength problem, of the number of wavelengths of feed horn and the number of wavelengths of dish and the ratio between the two at your operating frequency, the best you can do in most cases is to design a horn that in a Gaussian manner smears the power across the dish with 10 dB of aperture taper. The perimeter of the dish is being fed a signal 10 dB weaker than the center of the dish. That's the best you can do with feed horns. And when you do that, your dish has, let me pick a number, 60% overall aperture efficiency.
And what would be the impedance of that antenna?
Stop worrying about impedance. It's not relevant yet. I can find for you diffraction-limited parabolic surfaces that have 98% aperture efficiency. They're called diffraction-limited telescope. A telescope parabolic mirror can have 98% efficiency. The best I can do with my backyard 1296 dish is 55% efficiency. What the hell's happening? The reason why the diffraction-limited telescope can do that is because the parabolic reflector in that case is 300,000 wavelengths in diameter. The eyepiece, which is the feed horn, is 10,000 wavelengths in diameter. When you've got 10,000 wavelengths of diameter to play with at the eyepiece, that is the equivalent of a feed horn, which can evenly smear the power across the parabolic surface and waste none of it as spillover over the edges. You've got a lot of wavelengths to play with. That's the advantage of optical. At the radio wavelengths, where the wavelengths are much bigger, you ain't got that advantage. The best you can do is 10 dB aperture taper. Therefore, the perimeter of the dish is working a hell of a lot less hard for you than the center of the dish.
And what is the frequency range in gigahertz?
I'm telling you about what you and I are likely to do at, for instance, 1296, where the wavelength is, 9 inches. So at 9 inches of wavelength, my 24-foot diameter dish is, let me pick a number, 35 wavelengths of diameter. With 35 wavelengths of diameter of the dish and a couple of wavelengths of diameter of the feed horn, that's the best I can do, 9 dB taper. The 98% efficiency of the diffraction-limited telescope can get me 98% efficiency because the parabolic reflector is more than 100,000 wavelengths in diameter, and the eyepiece, which is the feed horn, is 10,000 wavelengths in diameter. That's the advantage of the higher frequency. As such, you can see that you're doing moon bounce as long as you can keep generating. Let me drop. If you can keep generating the same amount of transmit power, and if you can keep getting the same amount of receiver noise figure, the higher the frequency, the better. You have more and more wavelengths in that dish or that horn when you go to higher frequencies. As long as you can still generate more power, the same amount of power, and get the same receiver noise figure, I'm going to be way ahead of the game on moon bounce at 10 gigs compared to 1296, 1 gig. The higher the wavelength, the better. Now you know why very few guys do moon bounce at 28 megacycles. N2XJN, K2LIW.
Very much informative, thank you very much. Very much considering, I'm very interested with the way that you feed the antenna and trying to have the lowest possible losses on the transmission or the waveguide. That's why I asked you what would be the impedance of that horn antenna, if let's say we're talking about the horn antenna, and how then would you construct the pipe that would feed it with the electromagnetic wave.
Right now, the highest efficiency horns for amateur-like frequencies is the so-called Dick Turin horn, W2IMU, Richard Turin of Bell Laboratories, way back in 1970, invented the so-called dual-mode feed horn. It launches just the right ratio of TE11 circular and TM11 circular waveguide signal. That horn, in front of a dish, gives you the highest efficiency at that wavelength you're going to get with known techniques. The impedance that you see when you feed that horn is only a function of the way you did the waveguide to coax adapting. The horn is a piece of round waveguide. The way you launch that signal in the waveguide is what determines the impedance. If I'm willing to put a probe in my waveguide to coax adapter, and as I adjust the position of that signal launching probe, as I adjust its length and its position, I can give you any impedance you want from 1 ohm to 10,000 ohms.
Is it that when you keep in mind that the dimension of the pipe, or say the waveguide, should be greater than half of wavelength of the wave that is propagating through the waveguide? Am I correct in that?
The number of wavelengths across the mouth of the horn determines the 3 dB beamwidth of the horn. Depending on the focal length to diameter ratio of your dish, there is an ideal number of degrees of beamwidth coming out of the horn. Therefore, once you have chosen a dish of a particular focal length to diameter ratio, which means from the feed horn's point of view, the dish sweeps a certain number of degrees, that determines the number of wavelengths of diameter of the mouth of the horn. The way you taper the horn down to its piece of waveguide and the way you launch the signal into the waveguide is strictly your choices. Depending on how you make those choices of the way you launch the signal, you can make the impedance anything from 1 ohm to 10,000 ohms. You can make it capacitive, inductive, resistive. Just the way you adjust the launching probe of the waveguide to coax adapter controls the impedance that you see on the input connector of that horn. You've got complete control over that. There's no magic there. N2XJN, K2LIW.
Yeah, I believe last week you have mentioned the tapered or sloping aperture as the method of the adjustment of the impedance and ratio.
That's also true. At the input end of your horn, that's at the focal point of your dish, you could, if you want to, taper the waveguide as another method of getting a broadband impedance match. It's called the Minerva line, M-I-N-E-R-V-A phonetically. I'm not sure of the exact spelling of the man's name. But by tapered impedance techniques, whether you do it in waveguide, whether you do it in strip line, whether you do it in coax cable, no matter what kind of a transmission line you do it with, if you slowly taper the impedance in the right number of ohms per wavelength, you can easily go from 300 ohms down to 50 ohms as an impedance matching device and make it octave broad or maybe even a decade broad if you want to by do a slow taper. But most ham bands are nowhere near that broadband. You build a particular design of feed horn for 1296 and you build another design of feed horn for 432. you don't try to make 1 feed horn cover 432 through 1296. You could, if you want to, you'd be doing 10 times more work than you have to, because there are very few ham bands in between that you care about. So impedance matching, that's a separate item, and it's not magic. The right diameter of the horn to have the right beam width to properly feed that dish, that's reasonably well known. The accuracy of the parabolic surface that the dish has to have. Like, you'd have to have you'd like to have tenth of a wavelength of accuracy of the parabolic dish. So how you construct the dish, do you get the accuracy, will it survive the wind load and the snow load, do you have the right horn to feed it, does the horn have the right input impedance, does the horn launch linear, horizontal, vertical, circular polarization. You put all of those things into the design of the horn, and now you've done a very big chunk of the design of the antenna system for your moon bounce antenna.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
N2XJN, K2RIW, go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, interesting. During the week, I have had a number of emails and a copy of these emails. I have sent it to you. I was kind of very much amazed with the way that Roy has approached the subject of Eric Dollard and the whole crew and Marconi stuff whatsoever. Just for your curiosity, if you want to go deeper, just for to look at, I took a short stand at it. The guy is really, really brilliant, that's what I can say. Now, I have a question about atmosphere absorption attenuation of the electromagnetic wave. Let me jump. And also the question that is directly related to the question of Roy. Maybe we start with that. We don't have much time because we didn't discuss that. He's basically asking me to answer the question. Let me go to the phone. Please give me one specific response. If I take mechanically intact, relatively inelastic object, like a steel cable, that is 10 miles long, and have two guys holding it at either end, if this were really possible, let's do it in zero gravity. Do you believe that the same instant first guy starts pulling the cable, the other guy at the other end will feel this force on its size? Instantaneous action across the distance. Back to you.
Of course not. As one guy pulls at one end, and 10 miles away, the other guy is going to get the signal at the speed of sound in that steel cable. And if the speed of sound of that steel cable is, let me pick a number, 2 seconds per mile, and he's 10 miles away, he's going to know that I pulled on the cable 20 seconds later. Nothing like that can be instantaneous. Over to you, Wes, K2LAW.
Well, you're talking about the sound. Talking about the force, my response to his question was, no, I do not believe it is going to happen. At zero gravity, elasticity of the medium responsible for the transfer of vectors and direction still exists. But that does not discredit the general idea. We are talking about longitudinal waves in mechanics. I have an article which we don't have the time right now to go to, which describes what is the difference between the present day low frequency wireless transmitter and Tesla system. And the question was, when used as the wireless transmitter, how does the performance, efficiency and characteristic of an electrical oscillator change when working with the sphere capacitor antenna rather than working with the conventional monopole antenna? Just a few words on it. Send to it here.
For a second, I'm going to go back to the wire. If I put a loudspeaker connected to the wire at this end, and 10 miles away he puts a sensitive microphone, and I start playing music through the loudspeaker, and the music goes down the wire, and the microphone picks it up, that is sound. And the speed of sound, it might be 2 seconds per mile in steel, I'm not sure of the exact number, but it's probably in that neighborhood. And if it's 10 miles of wire, assuming the signal doesn't get too weak, you're going to hear the signal 20 seconds later. That's the sound wave. When I pull on the wire very gently with the loudspeaker, you and I call that sound. If I pull on the wire with my hand and I move it half a foot, you and I call that tension. But still, whether it's slow or fast, it's still the equivalent of sound. And yes, the sound traveling down that wire could be a longitudinal wave if I'm doing it by pushing and pulling. If I decide to use the wire in another way where I wiggle it left and right or wiggle it up and down, I'm now using the wire as a transverse medium. So I can use the wire either transverse or longitudinal. Yes. But that is not free space. I can't transmit a free space signal as a longitudinal wave.
But my question is, when one end is instantly put, the other one end will move at the same very moment, or it will not. And take care.
20 seconds later, to me, is it will not move instantaneous. There's going to be a 20-second delay in 10 miles of wire. Over to you, Wes.
To the sound, I agree. But would that be to the pretty much rigid medium? The medium was moved. And to exit.
Why don't you make it a steel bar, Wes?
A steel bar, right. Steel bar. Although I'm trying to keep the opposite to what you're saying, at least as much as I can. It's not easy with you. And to exit.
If I move the bar or the wire forward and reverse a very small amount, and if I do it with a loudspeaker, you and I call it sound. If I do it a very large amount, I could call it a very low frequency sound. I do it by pulling with my arm. Just because I do it by pulling with my arm doesn't make the signal travel down the wire faster. It's still the speed of sound. It's still going to take 20 seconds to get there 10 miles away.
But vectors and directions. Forget about the sound, forget about the frequency. Just vectors and directions. You apply the vector at one inch, and then you move the bar of 20 inches. Would the other end move at the same very time 20 inches and to here?
Yes, it's going to move 20 inches if I wait 20 seconds for it to happen. If I look at it microscopically, when I first start pulling on the bar, some of the very local molecules, I am stretching them. And it takes a certain length of time for those stretched molecules to communicate that stretch to the adjacent molecules. That is what you and I call the speed of sound in that medium. N2XJN, K2LIW.
Before I say my final car comment, John, what do you think about it?
Makes complete sense to me. Absolutely. There's a finite time of transmission. Just like I know that in a steel bar, sound will travel faster, much faster, than it does in air. But it still takes time.
Okay, so John, you have a, let's say, 10-meter long bar. You move one bar, one end of the bar, 20 inches to the left. And the other one end will move as well, as this is a steel bar. Would you see then, what delay then would you see with the other end moving?
Any acceleration in a direction is going to cause an elongation of that bar. Microscopically, but it's going to be elongation. And I think that takes time, doesn't it, Dick?
Here we go to the problem, guys. the ascending wave. When you look at the bottom of the ascending wave, you're not talking about a time delay. Andrew, here.
Yes, you are. Stand by. The only way you get a standing wave on a violin string, for instance, is there really is a sine wave of signal going from the top of the string to the bottom of the string. That signal is reflecting off of the thing that holds the string at the bottom, and there's another signal going from the bottom of the thing toward the top of the string. You only get a standing wave if there's two separate waves in motion, one moving from left to right, one moving from right to left. If you don't have two waves, then you don't have a standing wave. You have a traveling wave. You must have a traveling wave left to right, a traveling wave right to left. You mix the two together, then you call it a standing wave. You may not see it that way. The method by which you established the standing wave didn't allow you to easily see the two separate traveling waves. They've got to be there. If you had a perfect termination at the far end of the violin string, so that all the energy traveling from the top of the string down to the bottom of the string got absorbed, and there was no reflection, there would be no standing wave. There would only be a traveling wave. If you plot the positions of the string versus time, and you look at those plots and you know what you're looking at, there's a very distinct difference between a traveling wave and a standing wave. You only get a standing wave with two separate signals going. The standing wave ratio meter that we used for zillions of years, lecture wires or slotted line, requires the signal to go down the slotted line, hit the reflecting object, which is an imperfect load. Let me drop. And a certain percentage of the signal reflects back. There's a standing wave going forward, and there's a smaller standing wave coming back. Traveling wave going forward, and a smaller traveling wave coming back. The mixture between the two creates peaks and valleys that we call a standing wave. You gotta have a traveling wave in two directions to get a standing wave.
Yeah, I understand that. Very much making sense what you're saying. Another thing that I have, I was dealing with the resonance acoustical profile in geophysics. In here, United States, when I was working for the copper industry and gold mining industry, also working with USGS, United States Geophysical Survey, and the Army's Corps of Engineers, we utilized passive piezoelectric foil as a microphone to read ever-existing vibrations. And we were able to create a cutoff of the ground to the 2 kilometers, seeing all of the variations between the gravel sounds and the rock whatsoever. Now, there was I find out that sensitivity of the earth is absolutely amazing. So when I was studying other geophysical methods, most of them were just basing on the signal that was sent back, and whatever the fragments that were received from bouncing from the layers or whatever the structures were then analyzed to give the underground strata. But what I find out is that, and me and Igor Zikov and a few other guys of the crew, when we took a tip of the finger and we knock, let's say 1 inch, 2 inches nearby the vicinity of the sensor, then we had in the amplification of underground ever existing vibration of 10,000 times. Let me just. Basically, what was happening, and we've got a patent for it. Basically, what was happening is we were receiving the vibration that came from inside the earth, whether it was vibration created by mankind or then reflected, whether it was because of the movement of the earth around the sun, or the moon movement, or the rotation of the earth, or the internal structure of the earth vibrating due to the internal rotation, we've got this part. So at one point, I have formulated the telephone over the ground. Everything like this, of that, was working based on longitudinal mechanical wave. So then when I heard first time about Derek Dollard, and then Dr. Peter Litterman was supporting him, along with forget his name, the third guy. Then I said, this guy has some sense. So then when I got to the discussion with Roy, I'm kind of confused. Because I remember when I was reading the articles when I was a kid, the Indians used the runway to send the signal very fast and to Exia.
When they're using the railway to send a signal, are they sending an electrical signal or an acoustic signal?
Acoustic signal. What actually Eric was relating is that Marconi made his $1 billion investment, and I was reading about the financial state of the Marconi, it was true. Okay, and the government shut down, supposedly, his operation in 1921. Because of the activity of RTA, who was actually part of the government structure at that time, created to spy on him what he is doing, really. That's what the deep from what I've got. Is it true? I don't know, maybe. But I'm trying to go with that thinking pattern and my life experience in this area. Is it possible to send a mechanical wave or any kind of wave that should go to the other side of the earth and to Asia?
2 minutes, Wes.
When you're sending a piece of energy down a transmission medium, if it's a one-dimensional medium like a piece of coax cable, we talk about a velocity factor, and it might be 7/10 of the speed of light for my particular coax cable. I could be sending a signal into a three-dimensional medium like air or like the earth, and so it obeys the exact same rules. I can have a forward-going traveling wave, a reflection, a reverse-going traveling wave, and between the two, I can sense a standing wave. When I'm sending an acoustic signal through the earth or acoustic signal down a railroad track, if the speed of sound in the steel is 2 seconds per mile, and I'm sending signals down that to a person at normal human speed, and I'm sending a signal a couple of miles away, it'll seem like the signal gets there very fast, because it's a hell of a lot faster than air, because that's just the way steel behaves. It's a highly dense material, and it transmits sound very fast. Then I send a sound wave through the earth. It's being done all the time. Those seismic detectors know every time somebody explodes an atomic bomb anywhere on planet Earth, the seismic detectors pick up that sound wave some number of seconds or minutes later, and by the differential time of arrival on the individual seismic detectors, you play it backwards and you figure out exactly where that bomb was located. You're looking at the differential time of arrival because of the different distances that are sent, and because there's a finite speed of sound of that acoustic wave going through the earth. That's how you do direction finding. Into XJN, K2LIW.
Dick, is that a longitudinal wave?
Yes, it's longitudinal. It's first of all, there's a T wave and an S wave when it comes to seismic events, whether it be an earthquake or a bomb. There's a T wave and an S wave, and they travel at two different rates. Back to you, John.
Okay, I'm doing this quick. Just because it's a longitudinal wave, and it does take a finite time, there's a delta T, what Wesley's saying is not true, that it's instantaneous communications. Something's wrong there.
I didn't say it's instantaneous. I said it is possible.
Okay? I don't think instantaneous transmission across any finite distance instantaneously is possible. Show me evidence. I've never heard of it. Every medium has a speed at which the signal goes down that medium.
Okay, the last thing is, I sent you the FBI files of Nikola Tesla confiscated material, and there is an article from 1940, 3 years before the death of Nikola Tesla, standing about preparing to confiscate his estate.
Okay, when I get a chance, maybe I'll look at that. But do you believe that Marconi or Tesla, if there was no conspiracy, would have done a lot more progress? Is that what you're saying?
That's what I believe at best.
Okay. The conspirators who were stopping him from doing whatever he was doing, what was their motivation? Why did they do that?
Imagine a situation in which, theoretically, Marconi was able to put in his energy transmission over using the earth as a medium into the motion, and now he's ruling the whole world. I'm disconnecting the Australia whatsoever. So that's what I believe might have happened if it's true.